So I'll be presenting on a national multi-stakeholder initiative to facilitate cognitive impairment detection and earlier dementia diagnosis. So this is a work group that I'll be speaking about that was developed and is sponsored by the Gerontological Society of America. And Eli Lilly is supporting the GSA in basically underwriting the costs of putting the work group together. And I'm chair of the work group as a member of the Gerontological Society of America. So in that capacity, I don't have any direct personal financial relationships to report. This just shows, this is the smallest font you will see in my presentation, but this acknowledges everyone who's in the work group. This is a work group that includes representatives from many federal agencies, as well as the Alzheimer's Association, as well as consumer advocacy organizations such as Us Against Alzheimer's Disease. So there's broad representation from federal agencies and healthcare provider organizations. So if you want to know more about the work group and the report, I'll be mentioning that during the course of my presentation. So just as a brief overview, as the previous speaker mentioned, a diagnosis is a very imperfect science at this point in time when older people present with memory problems. But the best data available as far as the types of dementia and how they break down could be summarized by this umbrella figure. So the important thing for purposes of people and families affected by dementia in the end has to do with the kinds of symptoms that develop over the course of the disease. But from a diagnostic point of view, based on what we know now, of all of the types of dementia, depending on the study, Alzheimer's disease is the most common, representing about 50 to 75% of all dementia. Vascular dementia is next most common, followed by Lewy body, and then frontotemporal dementia. And you'll be hearing later about frontotemporal dementia in one of our talks. The prevalence will continue to grow, also as was mentioned by our previous speaker regarding San Diego County, but in terms of nationally, this is one recent paper that estimates national prevalence growth over the course of the next 35 years or so. The black line represents the 65 and older population and shows that in the year 2015, where we are right now, there are slightly over 5 million Americans living with Alzheimer's disease, and that's expected to go to between 13 and 14 million Americans by the middle of the century. And if Alzheimer's represents 50 to 75% of dementias, then obviously the numbers of people with all types of dementia is greater even than these figures, and it's projected to be greater. These are the most common cognitive and behavioral symptoms associated with dementia. Memory loss is often, but not always, the hallmark symptom, depending on ultimately the type of dementia. Such everyday activities as completing familiar tasks are often interrupted or impaired by people who have dementia. These are probably common and probably known to a lot of you in this room, but I really put them on the slide just to just show the kinds of ways that these types of dementias do affect people and their families. And as the disease progresses, such behaviors as wandering and more severe agitation and other behavioral and neuropsychiatric symptoms often develop in people who have dementia. Dementia has a great impact on families as well as people with dementia. Families have a great uncertainty about the disease process. Even when a diagnosis is made, families are often wondering, well, what's going to happen next? What's going to happen with my relative? How do I prepare for the future? As if that's not enough, the uncertainty, the fact is that as a person with dementia symptoms progress, families become more responsible for making decisions on behalf of their relative and for providing hands-on care responsibilities. And there have been a lot of studies. The two citations on this slide go back more than 15 years now. There's a mountain of evidence that shows that family caregivers themselves are at great health risk due to the stress and the burden of providing care to relatives with dementia, including a study that has shown that they're at greater risk for mortality compared to non-caregivers, particularly if it's a spouse caregiver who's under stress. So with all that as background, we kind of get to what the work group is really focused on, which has to do with how do we improve detection of cognitive impairment in this country, particularly at the primary care level, and then have the detection of cognitive impairment lead to ultimately referral to community resources for patients and families. So numerous studies have found gaps and barriers to the detection of cognitive impairment, in the particularly in the primary care setting, where a lot of the research has been done. And it's really essential for earlier diagnosis, not just to make it earlier diagnosis, but so that a patient and a family really understands that this is an irreversible situation. And oftentimes it takes a diagnosis of some sort in order to be referred to different types of community services. So detection of cognitive impairment is really an important first step. Other reasons why action is needed now to improve the way that primary care providers do a job of detecting cognitive impairment include things like there are health disparities that have been shown. African Americans and Hispanics, particularly those are the ethnic minority groups that have been studied, the racial and ethnic minority groups, most often, and it's been shown that they often experience longer delays than non-Hispanic whites between the initial awareness of cognitive impairment and visiting a doctor to find out what's wrong. So there's a great need to try to get people of color and to kind of level the playing field in terms of having families across the board get involved in visiting primary care providers if there's a concern about cognition of any sort. So without concerted action to increase cognitive impairment detection, these barriers and these health disparities will only grow due to the projected increase in the population prevalence estimates that I already showed you. So the work group charge was to summarize efforts currently underway by national, governmental, and related organizations to identify evidence-based assessment tools that are available to primary care providers for detecting cognitive impairment. And then secondly, to really use the Medicare annual wellness visit that became part of, that was established as part of the Affordable Care Act, to use that wellness visit as a springboard for more widespread and systematic use of evidence-based cognitive assessment tools in the primary care setting. So I already mentioned about the annual wellness visit. The annual wellness visit does include very broad language about detection of any cognitive impairment. It's supposed to be one of the things that physicians do as part of the primary care, the annual wellness visit. But no specific assessment tools were mandated as part of the federal legislation. And so part of what we did as a work group, as you will see, is summarize the available detection tools that are available online and brief types of assessments that could be used in a busy primary care setting. So what the work group has done to date is we've designed a diagram to try to summarize and illustrate the flow of Medicare beneficiaries and family members through the annual wellness visit, starting with detection of cognitive impairment all the way through post-diagnosis community resource referrals. We developed recommended actions for primary care providers related to steps along this flow diagram, and we are in the process now of organizing a national stakeholder summit, which is actually going to be held in 2016, not 2015. It takes a while to plan a summit, as you might know. So we're expecting at this point, and I'll mention that toward the end of my talk, at convening a summit of key stakeholders to try to implement the recommendations from our report. So this is the flow diagram, which is kind of the core of our work. And what we're trying to do is we tried to develop an acronym that might more or less make sense to people. And so the acronym is KAER. So it's a homonym for the word care. It's not great or perfect, but that's kind of what we came up with. So the first step, step one, basically says if an older adult, a Medicare beneficiary, is visiting a primary care provider as part of the annual wellness visit, what we want the primary care provider to do is at least kickstart the cognition conversation. That's what the K stands for, kickstart that cognition conversation. Because it's not always the case that an older adult absolutely needs to be screened, and in fact the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force did not recommend universal screening. So we were very careful not to recommend universal screening. We did not want to be at odds with the Preventive Services Task Force. But what we did say is that an important first step is to at least, if there is no complaint by an older adult or complaint by a family member, the PCP should be prepared to at least start talking about cognition and aging and how it's important to think about preventive measures to maintain cognition if there are no cognition problems at that point. So we're not recommending screening right away. But if there is a complaint, if an older person comes in and says, I'm concerned about my memory, or if the family member says, I'm concerned about my loved one's memory, or if the primary care provider notices a subtle change in their patient from the last time that they saw them regarding cognitive impairment, then at that point, for those kinds of situations, we are recommending the movement towards step two, which is the A, which is assess if there are symptoms that are of concern. So for symptomatic beneficiaries, the primary care provider would use an evidence-based assessment tool to detect cognitive impairment. And then the third step is, if that detection tool basically shows that there is cognitive impairment to some degree, we are recommending go to step three, which would be the PCP would first rule out reversible causes of cognitive impairment, and if there are no reversible causes found, either if they are equipped to do it as primary care providers, conduct a more thorough diagnostic evaluation or refer the patient and family to a specialist to get a more thorough diagnostic evaluation. So we were really, really careful to distinguish between doing an initial cognitive impairment detection assessment on the one hand and a diagnosis on the other hand. They are not one and the same, although many primary care providers, after doing even a brief screen, will pronounce a diagnosis, and then forevermore an older adult will have that diagnosis. And what we are trying to say is that that's not what the evidence shows. It's important to distinguish between detecting cognitive impairment and then going on and getting a full-blown diagnosis by a specialist. And then once a diagnosis is made, because, you know, specialists could distinguish different types of dementia, not Alzheimer's type dementia definitively, because that can only be determined definitively after death by brain autopsy. But, for example, a vascular dementia could be determined if a full diagnostic workup determines that. Plus, neuropsych testing could really determine the degree of cognitive impairment regardless of the cause. And it could be determined by that point that it's an irreversible dementia because all reversible causes will have been ruled out. And then as a final step, and in a lot of ways this is really what's most important to patients and families, they're living with a diagnosis, but refer them to community services. And every locality obviously has a different amount of community services, but they're mushrooming. You know, the amount of community services available to patients and families living with a dementia is really greatly increasing. So, but everything starts from the point of view of this work group with kickstarting that cognition conversation, or if there are symptoms, moving on toward detection of cognitive impairment. So as part of step two, the work group did a thorough review of other reviews, really, that had been done to determine what are the brief available evidence-based cognitive impairment detection tools that could be used in the setting of primary care. And on the left-hand column, we summarized those very brief evidence-based detection assessment tools that had been discovered through a very, very detailed systematic review by the National Institute on Aging's working group that was actually commissioned by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services a few years ago to come up with tools that physicians would use or other primary care providers, say nurse practitioners or physician's assistants. Because brevity is important, but so is good psychometric property. So the list of screening tools is on the very left-hand column, and then the X's show what the NIA working group came up with. And then separate from the NIA effort, the Alzheimer's Association convened its own expert work group a few years ago and published their findings regarding what kinds of brief assessment tools they thought that had the most evidence available to them. And the two that kind of showed up on both lists, if you will, was something called the AD8 or the Ascertained Dementia 8, and also the MINICOG. So we're not recommending that those are the two to use. We're being very careful as a work group not to impose our will on anybody, but we wanted to show that there is a selection that primary care providers could make. And some of the criteria that we used, again, they had to be brief, they had to be free, in other words, they had to be available online, and also we tried to stay away from those that are copyrighted. It turns out you will not see the mini mental state exam, for example, on this list, and the MMSE has become copyrighted, and so that's an affront to some providers, and so we decided to keep with the as a work group, as one of the criteria, keep with tools that are free of charge and available online. So for step three, if cognitive impairment is determined through assessment to be present, as I've already mentioned, the PCP should rule out reversible causes of cognitive impairment, and these are things like depression, polypharmacy, thyroid disorders, things like that. I am not a clinician, so I will not go into greater detail about what those are. But there are reversible causes that should be ruled out firstly. And again, we made that important distinction between detecting cognitive impairment on the one hand and arriving at an accurate diagnosis on the other hand. And referring to qualified specialists for a full diagnostic workup, that's very clear in our report. And then I just wanted to spend a few minutes on step four, which is really referring to community resources and also referring to clinical trials. I mean, there's obviously a big interest. That was not at all our primary interest in this work group, in other words, to spur people to go to clinical trials. But we do realize that there is an interest in having people enroll in clinical trials, so scientists who are working more on trying to understand what's going on in the brain to develop at least pharmaceutical kinds of therapies, they need people to enroll in clinical trials. And there are a lot of clinical trials available now, so we wanted to make sure that without that first step, you'll never get to the fourth step of referral to community services. So these are examples of some of the dementia-capable community services that we outlined in our report, chapters of the Alzheimer's Association, area agencies on aging. In many communities, there are now adult day programs that have expertise in dementia care. In other words, they have staff available to them in those programs who have been trained in working sensitively and with dignity with people with dementia. And there are also assisted living facilities, as some of you in the room might already know, that are focused on having residents in their facilities who have dementia. And then there's increasingly accessible information and programs for people with dementia and family caregivers available online and available often in local communities. There's a lot of non-drug treatments that I just wanted to mention that have been tested with funding from the NIH. There are really more than 50 so-called non-pharmacologic or non-drug treatments and care practices that are available in the sense that they've been tested and found to have positive benefits in randomized trials. And a lot of them are now at the point of trying to get integrated into community settings where they could be more available to the broader population. So there's insufficient awareness among primary care providers about these services as well. So we're hoping that through this report and getting primary care providers to focus on the very upstream, you know, step one and step two, that they will also become more available, more aware of services that are already available in their communities. And these are the kinds of health outcomes that are kind of ultimately at the end of our flow chart that we would really like to improve or, you know, see at a population level improve as a result of these steps being taken. And there are outcomes that we outlined with regard to the person with dementia, and there are also outcomes of interest with regard to family caregivers. And these are outcomes that have been studied in many, many different publications. So I'm just winding up now. We've disseminated the report since the beginning of 2015. We released this report and the recommendations, and they are available at that website there. That's the GSA's website, and then /CI is for cognitive impairment. So you could download a copy of the full report and recommendations if you'd like. And so we've been presenting since releasing the report at a variety of venues, including today, so to try to get the word out. And then finally, I mentioned that we're planning a summit. And the idea is to secure broad adoption of these recommended steps. And the target audiences, well, we have several stakeholders that we're planning to invite. Primary care provider professional membership organizations, some of whom have representatives on the work group itself, but we're reaching out to physician assistant organizations, nurse practitioner associations, because they often will do this kind of assessment in busy primary care settings, especially if it's something like an accountable care organization, you know, where there are teams that are available beyond physicians to do primary care work. We're also planning to invite representatives from at least a few Medicare Advantage plans and Medicare Quality Improvement organizations, and of course consumer advocacy organizations that are already on the GSA work group, but also some others as well. And then we're planning to invite some people with dementia and family caregivers as well. And this is going to be a nomination process, obviously, through the members of the work group. So other issues that we plan to deal with at the summit particularly are trying to align the expectation of patients and providers with the intent of the annual wellness visit. We are aware that electronic health records are very common now, so we really want to try to work the results of these cognitive impairment detection techniques into EHRs. We want to address cultural and linguistic diversity in the target population, and then ultimately we'd like to test our recommendations. So if you're more interested in learning more about the summit, here's a contact person at the GSA. And then with that, I'll end my presentation. Thanks very much.